With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Storms have improved the outlook for California farming. Agriculture Summit is told. The outlook for California's agricultural economy shows some signs of improvement after several years of supply chain constraints, high input costs, and a multi-year drought that forced farmers to fallow acres and remove orchards. Economic analyst David Magana of Rabobank recently told attendees during a Food and Agricultural Issues Summit in Sacramento that the drenching storms that hit the state earlier this year turned the tide, contributing to a more positive outlook for agriculture this year. The event featured discussions on topics including water, labor, and farm policy. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Budget environment challenges Farm Bill writers. A suddenly changed political environment for budgeting on Capitol Hill is posing new challenges for Farm Bill writers, who are already facing daunting October 1st deadlines to complete work on a new bill. It's a tale of two GOPs, a Senate GOP ready to stick with fiscal year 2023 spending figures next fiscal year based on the House Speaker's debt deal with the President, and rebellious House conservatives demanding deeper cuts. American Farm Bureau's Director of Governmental Affairs, Dustin Shear, says the fight over near-term spending cuts won't have an immediate farm bill impact.
The appropriations level doesn't have anything to do with negotiating out farm bill authorization levels. Other than, again, it's just, you know, creating a little bit of rancor between parties and the chambers.
Most of the farm bill is automatic mandatory spending like SNAP, but even there, appropriators have already pushed savings via expanded work requirements.
They're the ones who control the money.
Longer term, the McCarthy-Biden debt limit budget deal leaves no new farm bill money, nor does it change political realities.
It's a split Congress a year before a presidential election in a tight fiscal environment. But no farm bill has been the same as a different farm bill. They've all moved in different circumstances, under different fiscal pressures and different economies.
But with spending differences this year, not just between the two parties, but within a GOP that controls one chamber, and with little time left to produce a farm bill that in the past has taken months or more to enact. NAFB contributed to that report. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
Listening sessions will continue through September on proposed changes in prevented planting crop insurance coverage. Risk Management Agency Administrator Marcia Bunger explains what some of the proposed changes entail.
One is the harvest price option. Currently, with Prevent Plant, the only price that is applicable is the spring price. But much like the counterparts of those acres that are being harvested, we are wanting feedback on whether to allow the Prevent Plant payment calculation to be based upon the higher of the projected price or the harvest price. The second topic will be the 1-in-4 rule. Currently, we have the rule of planting one in the last 4 years to then be eligible for Prevent Plant. We are wanting to discuss the 1-in-4 rule and how it applies to folks that are in those Prevent Plant types of situations.
Growers looking to cut costs can look at approaches for lowering weed control intensity in orchards. Extension weed science specialist at UC Davis, Brad Hansen, said one intensity reduction idea is reducing the retreatment interval.
Basically just increasing the duration between interventions because every trip to that orchard costs. So if you can eliminate one spray trip and one or two mowings in that season by living with a little bit more weed pressure, you've saved that operation cost and materials cost in the case of the herbicides. And then kind of the last thing was considering whether you need every component of the tank mix. I would say there's a lot of our intense tank mix programs, the additional products, that second or third or fourth component of that tank mix might be trying to help you achieve those last couple percent of weed control. So if you can reduce your expectations a few percent, you might be able to knock one or two of the products out of that tank mix and still get quite good weed control.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, Dr. Kathy Urich, Dean of the College of Natural and Agricultural Sciences at the University of California, Riverside, was one of six witnesses at a House Agriculture Subcommittee hearing on research. Congresswoman Kat Kamick of Florida asked her about research into citrus greening.
In your testimony, you write about citrus greening disease and the devastating impact that this disease has on the citrus industry. This isn't just a Florida problem, but we're seeing this across the industry as a whole. As a member of the Sunshine State, I have personally seen the devastating impacts where we have gone from 250 million boxes in the early 2000s to now about 30,000 boxes in production. You mentioned specifically the Emergency Citrus Disease Research and the Extension Program, which has been implemented to combat citrus greening. Now, as we look to draft the Farm Bill this year, can you speak to the importance of maintaining this important program, specifically the need to continue funding? Because as we all know, research is not something you can turn on and off like a light switch. It requires that continual investment. Do you see light at the end of the tunnel, and can you speak to that importance?
Yes, I see light at the end of the tunnel. There's a lot we can do. We brought up this before. Having that continued research over long term, particularly for trees, which take decades to mature, is extremely important for this process. So as you know, citrus greening disease is devastating, not just in Florida. We're very concerned about this in California. And we use all the tools in the toolbox that we can have, from high-end genomic sequencing to splicing, and plant breeding, everything that we can have that we can possibly do to make sure that the disease does not affect California and the rest of the country we're working on. And it is a long-term plan. And if it's not citrus, it could be citrus greening disease this day, but it might be something else for peaches and almonds and pistachios in the future.
Congresswoman Mary Miller of Illinois asked about soil health research and conservation efforts.
Soil health, yes. You need clean air, clean soil, clean water in order to grow most of our crops. So yes, with my colleagues, we're doing a lot of research in that area. But I'll do this very short. The coolest thing that I think we're doing right now is what I'll call space tomatoes. So the ability to grow tomatoes in space. So really the idea is you want the fruit to be bigger and the leaves to be smaller. So if you're going to grow it out in space, you have to figure out what the right light wavelength is going to be. This is work that is funded by the USDA as well as NASA. So it is also something that is drawing a lot of philanthropic interest too. But it is, and if we can grow it out in space, that is also going to help our food insecurity. But it really starts with understanding how plants grow under certain conditions.
Congressman Mark Alford of Missouri asked if competition from other nations was an issue.
Reiterate for me again, Dr. Urich, why is it so important to increase the investments in ag research on our end to keep pace with some of these countries like China, who is really a pacing threat to our national security?
I'll say very simply why it's important, because we all need to eat. So we need to make sure that we're ensuring the safety of our food supply. So safe food, food production, food capacity, all aspects of food, we need to make sure that we have that in hand. And we are falling behind. And I'll just say, it's not just food, it's not just agriculture, it's many other areas that we're falling behind relative to the BRICS. But I strongly endorse, we need to make sure, again, I said clean, we talked about soils, clean soil, clean air, clean water. We need to have a clean and healthy and abundant food supply. We're all here to work to make sure that happens. And anything we can do to support you, we offer our services.
Thank you, Doctor.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's Livestock Report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the lowering of cheese prices and USDA's latest dairy forecast led to similar adjustments among product and class price categories. With more on that story, here's Rod Bain.
Minimum changes in production. Several adjustments in price. The summary for USDA's June outlook for dairy. World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski says most changes in production categories occurred for the current marketing year.
Milk production for 2023, we reduced 200 million pounds just based on slower anticipated growth in milk per cow.
Meanwhile, price adjustments were made for both 2023 and 2024.
One that kind of stands out is lower cheese prices for 2023. We lowered our cheese price forecast by 9 cents per pound. We also reduced our cheese price forecast for 2024, lowered it by 4 cents a pound.
The lower cheese price forecast led to a lowering of Class 3 milk prices and lower all milk prices for both years. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. And World Ag Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski reviews USDA's latest forecast for milk class and all milk prices for 2023 and 2024.
For 2023, Class 3 price, we reduced by $1.05 per hundredweight, and that mainly reflects the lower cheese and whey prices. Class 4 price, on the other hand, we raised by 5 cents per hundredweight, mainly reflecting some strength in butter prices. So the all milk price, we reduced it this month by 55 cents per hundredweight, currently now at $19.95 for the calendar year. And for 2024, Class 3 price, we reduced that this month by 50 cents per hundredweight, year over year. Year up slightly, 30 cents per hundredweight, 2024 compared to 2023. Class 4 prices for 2024 up a little bit, up 10 cents, mainly reflecting some strength in the non-fat dry milk price. Class 4 price for next year forecast at $17.45 per hundredweight. That would be down 90 cents per hundredweight year over year. And the all milk price for next year is now forecast at $19.65 per hundredweight, and that would be down 30 cents year over year.
Again, that was World Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski. And the National Cattlemen's Beef Association Young Cattlemen's Conference program concluded its successful relaunch after a three-year hiatus. This year's class included 71 leaders from across the country in every sector of the beef industry. After 9 days of intensive training, including a five-city tour showcasing every facet of the beef industry, members completed the trip with a full day of representation in Washington, D.C. The event is designed to expose participants to the full supply chain. Completing the YCC prepares participants to serve as leaders within their state associations, in addition to being advocates for the NCBA and the beef community. Learn more on their website, ncba.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Many crops depend on healthy pollinators. From beetles to flies, hummingbirds, bats, and bees, pollinators are essential in helping turn pollen into food. June 19th through 25th is National Pollinator Week, reminding us of the key role pollinators play in preserving natural habitats and producing successful crops. This message is brought to you by Syngenta, committed to protecting the safety and health of pollinators that feed and fuel the world.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The USDA is investing in supply chains. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The USDA is investing $320 million to create new and better markets for agricultural producers and food businesses in 19 states across rural America. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says the goal is to expand processing capacity, create fairer markets and more revenue streams, and market opportunities to help bring down food costs for families at the grocery store. He goes on to say they're partnering with entrepreneurs in rural areas to build brighter futures, connect business owners to new markets, and create good jobs for generations to come. Some examples of the projects include a family-owned business like a meat market and a bison processing facility, that will be able to expand production capabilities, maintain the highest quality control possible, and save jobs. For more information on the opportunities through the USDA Rural Development, you can find a link in this story on our website at agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCowan. In late 2019, the Congress passed the SECURE Act, which made significant changes to retirement plans and impacted retirement planning. We're still waiting for guidance on some provisions of that law. In 2022, SECURE Act 2.0 became law, but it has at least three errors that need to be fixed. The SECURE Act increased the required minimum distribution age from 70.5 to age 72. With SECURE Act 2.0, the RMD increased age 73 effective January 1, 2023. It goes to age 75 starting in 2033. But for those born in 1959, there are currently two RMD ages in 2033. It's either 73 or 75 that year. The correct age is likely 75, but it needs to be clarified. Another error involves Roth IRAs. Starting in 2024, if you earn more than $145,000 in 2023, you'll have to do non-deductible catch-up contributions in Roth form. But the law says that all catch-up contributions starting in 2024 will be disallowed. This also needs to be corrected. And there's an issue with SEPs and simple plans allowed to do Roth contributions and how those contributions impact Roth limitations. Congress needs to fix these issues this year. If it does, it will likely be late in 2023. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCowan.
Back when Central Tennessee realtor Renee Veach was beginning her career,
there was a very wise, seasoned agent in our office that had been using the USDA Direct program for years for her clients. And she told me about it, and I thought, you know, this is really great. I'll look into it.
Time passed, and she had forgot about this piece of advice. Until she
started having clients that were first-time homebuyers that were coming to me that were not able to be traditionally qualified through traditional financing. What I call just go to work every day kind of people that don't have a ton of money in the bank, but they pay their bills on time, and a lot of them pay cash direct. And so most conventional lenders, they want to have your credit score, and they want to have all these lines of trade that they have to use. And so they didn't necessarily qualify traditionally for traditional lending.
So that led to Veach's discovery of the USDA Rural Development Direct program and its benefits, and the realization
this program was exactly what they needed. The little to no down payment was a win-win. The fixed interest rate that is lower than what we currently have on the secondary market.
And particularly in the case of the 502 direct loan program,
if they are traditionally low income earners, they get the monthly stipend or supplement that goes with it that helps them pay that mortgage, which enables them to ultimately be homeowners, which in reality, that's everybody's dream. They don't want to have to rent. They just want to have a place of their own, especially for young families and things like that, that they're growing. They don't want to have to be in that transient situation where rent might not work out, or more importantly, rent is so much more expensive than even houses are right now. And your landlord can do whatever they want to do. They can charge whatever they want to charge.
So after delving into the various aspects of the Rural Development Direct Housing Loan Program,
I have worked this program successfully for about 7 clients over the last year and a half. Got several in the works right now that are in the pipeline.
And she says in the case of her area, Dixon County, Tennessee, its location is perfectly set for the direct loan program to assist rural clients and those coming into Dixon County due to region-wide growth.
One of the caveats to Dixon County is we are just outside of Nashville, Tennessee, Davidson County, and everything is kind of coming west because Nashville is just booming, and we are very convenient to Nashville. So the benefit of having all of our county rural is wonderful with this particular program because most all of the properties qualify for the rural development loan, and the interest rates are low.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
As the nation remains mired in a period of high inflation, the need for Social Security is growing, according to AARP Oklahoma State Director Sean Voskel.
It is hard to overstate the importance and the impact of Social Security. For most people over retirement age, Social Security is the largest source of income. It's even more important for rural residents and farmers who may not have 401ks or IRAs. Given these realities, we must keep Social Security strong.
Social Security puts retirement in reach for millions of Americans. However, Voskal says the critical program faces a long-term shortfall.
If Congress doesn't take action to protect and save Social Security in the next 10 years, your Social Security could be cut 20% on an average of $4,000 a year. Social Security isn't a handout. We've paid into it our entire working lives. It's only fair that politicians protect the money we've earned.
Many Americans have little or no savings. People are living longer, and employer-paid pensions are increasingly scarce. Fortunately, AARP's Social Security Resource Center can help them navigate those challenges.
AARP's Social Security Resource Center has the answers to important questions. So when Americans are thinking about retirement, they know how to access what they've earned. You'll find a benefits calculator and a place to take action and tell your elected officials how important Social Security is to you and your family.
Find AARP's Social Security Resource Center at aarp.org/Social Security and learn more Thursday night at 9 p.m. Central Time on RFD TV or online at aarp.org/AARP Live. Michael Clements reporting.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
And now, another episode of One Soil to Live.
All right, let's take a look, Claude. I see you've been keeping it covered.
Yes, I have.
And it appears you haven't disturbed it.
I've tried really hard not to.
You're using living roots throughout the year with diverse species and rotations, right?
Just exactly as you prescribed, Doctor.
Well, I'll have to say I'm impressed with your organic matter, aggregation, and microbial activity. Claude, I'm happy to report that your soil is fit as a fiddle.
Oh, thank you. I guess it's true that soil health management systems are just what the doctor ordered.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Improving soil health can make your farm more productive, profitable, and resilient. Visit your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today and learn more about the basics and benefits of soil health. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
A month ago today, the Mississippi River was cresting above flood stage from St. Paul south past the Quad Cities. Today, 30 days later, as summer begins, low water levels are affecting barge traffic in that same area. I'm Mark Oppold with your Bottom Line Report, brought to you by Superior Livestock. The weekly crop update confirming worsening drought conditions in major states, and that same hot, dry weather has quickly reduced water levels on the Mississippi. The American Commercial Barge Line reporting a 6% reduction in loading capacity on the upper Mississippi and a 15% reduction from St. Louis to Memphis. The locks and dam system north of St. Louis can better deal with low water levels, but not this early in the season. Elsewhere, it was quite evident in the grain trade yesterday, buyers are not fearing a big setback. In fact, watch yesterday's lows: December corn 588.5, November soybeans 1324.25 could be lows for the week. Superior Livestock's recent tall grass auction of feeders coming off grass in the Kansas Flint Hills, $50 to $70 higher for similar cattle a year ago. The demand continues strong. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Farm Bureau and CLAAS of America recently signed a Memorandum of Understanding on Right to Repair. Emily Bunkman, AFBF Director of Government Affairs, says this is one of five MOUs on the issue.
The latest MOU in our series of MOUs that we have gotten signed over the last 6 months bring our total to five MOUs with different ag equipment manufacturers. We're excited because these represent and cover approximately 3/4 of the U.S. market for tractors and ag machinery.
Bunkman says the effort gives farmers and ranchers more options when it comes to repairing equipment.
We provide farmers and ranchers the opportunity to have access to documentation, diagnostic codes, opportunities to purchase parts and specialty tools directly from the manufacturer, as well as gain assistance from the manufacturer. It's also important to note that it's not only for the farmer or rancher, but also independent repair shops have access to these tools as well, which gives our members more options when it comes to getting their equipment repaired.
Buckman adds right to repair is an important issue for farmers and ranchers and a priority for AFBF.
A piece of equipment is a major investment. Farmers should have the freedom to choose where equipment is repaired to help control costs. So having access to these tools allows a farmer and rancher the ability to repair their own equipment. And now that we have 3/4 of market share in the U.S. covered by these 5 MOUs, we're excited for the momentum that we've gained, and we look forward to continuing to explore other opportunities with additional manufacturers.
Learn more at FB.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
Depending on where you live, you may already have had a severe summer heat wave, a time when people say,
it's too darn hot. It's too
hot that it's dangerous for people to be out in it.
So if it's dangerous for people, it is usually dangerous for pets as well.
Something pet owners should bear in mind. This according to Agriculture Department veterinarian Dr. Dawn Fitzhugh. And she says it doesn't have to be near 100 degrees to be a serious problem for certain dogs. She says problems can start in some pets when it's, say, 85 degrees out.
So when it gets above 85, most of the time we really want to pay attention to the heat, the humidity, and our pet's condition when they're out there.
Before taking our dogs out in the heat, Dawn says we should ask ourselves some questions.
Is our pet used to this type of heat? Are they overweight? Are they underweight? Are they older? Are they really young? So all of those things can come into play as to how our pets can tolerate the heat.
And certain breeds have more trouble in hot weather than others. We'll get to that in a minute. But dogs in general are susceptible to heat stroke because, unlike we humans who have sweat glands all over our bodies to help cool us down,
dogs and cats, for the most part, only really perspire or sweat through some sweat glands in their feet.
Which doesn't help much. And so for dogs, their only real cooling mechanism is this. Yes, panting. And for some dogs, that's not enough to keep them from becoming dangerously hot and dying from it. Dawn says that does happen, even when dogs are accustomed to, say, 80 degrees, and they're okay with that.
But if you suddenly go from, say, an 80-degree temperature to now, you know, might climb up over 100 with some of these weather changes we've been seeing, like sudden swings in temperatures, that's where it's extremely dangerous.
Because some dogs won't cut back on running and fetching and such. They just want to have fun.
And so before we know it, we can slip into something really dangerous that was meant to be fun because they're not going to limit themselves.
That's up to us, owners, to limit them and watch for signs of trouble. Dawn says certain breeds are more prone to heat stroke than others.
The Alaskan Malamutes, who have that thick fur, they're going to be especially vulnerable. And the dogs with the little pushed-in faces that are super cute, so like your pugs and your French bulldogs, those guys are going to be especially vulnerable when it comes to heat. So we want to be really careful with some of those dogs in particular.
And no matter what the breed, there are signs of trouble we should be watching for and guarding against. And we'll talk about those next time. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders.
Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, with this week's Almond Matters, brought to you by Valent USA. Growers will want to give themselves time to get in front of any potential ant problems.
In today's Almond Matters segment, we're joined by Field Market Development Specialist with Valent USA, Todd Birkdahl, to talk a little bit about ant management in orchards. And now, Todd, you've actually been doing a bit of traveling here recently, providing some instruction on how to protect against ant damage here. And so what were some of the highlights there that growers will want to keep in mind when it comes to ants?
Well, the biggest thing on ants is getting them early before they get you. You know, as the season progresses, your almond crop is maturing. Before we know it, we'll be shaking them, putting them on the ground. That's when ants become problematic, because they go to the protein source, or the almond kernel as a protein source, and then, you know, they chew away at it and cause damage, which causes you problems with the processor. So controlling the ants now with baits works really, really well, because you get them before, as the populations are starting to build, they're out foraging, they pick up the bait, they take it back to the colony where the queen, the brood, is fed that ant bait, and it affects the entire population. I'm referring to a steam ant bait. It's the active ingredient piperoxifen, and acts as an IGR, insect growth regulator, mimicking juvenile hormones within the insects. So they don't grow. They continue to grow, but they stay in the same stage. They rupture, their exoskeleton ruptures, and they die. The queen, on the other hand, she becomes sterile, and the eggs she lays are sterile. And so consequently, you annihilate the entire population very, very, it's not a real rapid annihilation, but it's over about 5 to 7, 10 days, depending on activity, temperatures, and whatnot, how active they are. You see the ants, they literally disappear. And of course, they've been eating the ant bait, and the workers that are out there die, and then the young ones don't come on board. And so no succession plan in place. Death takes its toll on the colony. Biggest thing with that is getting the bait to where the ants are. So typically you'd put it out in the middle of the orchard, because along the middles, especially with micro sprinklers or drip irrigation, you don't want the ant bait to get wet. It would, you know, dilute it and cause it to be not as effective. So you want it to be basically in a dry situation, put it in the middles. They're out there feeding anyway. They pick it up, they take it back to the colony, and they die. So, you know, you don't want to put out too much. You waste the product. You don't want to put out too little. Basically, you want to spread it out over the entire orchard. You know, again, row middles are, I think, the best place to put it, away from irrigation. So ants are going to go to water. They need water like we need water, but at the same time, they're going to feed in those row middles. And so they'll find it. You put it out there, they'll find it. Ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Right now is probably the ideal time as far as the 2023 season goes. Putting it out now in the next couple weeks here before July 1st, and you'll get good kill. That's it in a nutshell. No pun intended on the nutshell, but that's where the ants are going to go to inside the nutshell.
And now, you noted a timeline of getting out there before July 1st as a good rule of thumb, but what kind of impact does weather have on ant populations? It hasn't been quite as hot as it's been in the past few years, so is that going to impact things there?
Well, I mean, ants, like any other insect, are, you know, heat degree day independent. So we've had relatively cool weather. It's been, you know, I think yesterday it was, might have got to 90, but I'm not even sure it got to 90. Maybe in my truck it got to 90, but outside at high 80s. Nights have been relatively cool in the low 60s. So it's not typical summer like we're used to this time, by, you know, with triple digits already. So a little bit delayed, I would say, with progression as far as insect pressure overall, including ants. I'm thinking it's probably going to compensate before too long. Cool spring, hot summer, hot the rest of the summer. coming up on the first day of summer, July or June 21st. So I think that as the temperatures heat up, the activity is going to increase. There's plenty of moisture in the ground. There's, you know, food sources out there for them. And, you know, old mummy nuts and stuff that got knocked off. And they'll eat anything that's a protein source, seeds, you know, plants, weed seeds, and whatnot. But the biggest thing is you want to control that population before you put your nuts on the ground, before you shake. Because after that, it's a free-for-all. So getting the ant bait on the ground at least 2 to 3 weeks before the first shake, and I'd say even earlier than that. The steam is not fast. It takes time. They've got to literally cycle out being an insect growth regulator. It's very effective, very thorough, but they do have to cycle out. So it's not like you put it out there and tomorrow they're all dead. You've got to put it out there. They pick it up. They feed on it. They take it back to the colony, and they feed the brood. They feed the queen. As I said, she becomes sterile. The brood doesn't. They don't become mature ants, and so you major disruption in the colony, if not a total annihilation. So, getting out there before things get out of hand is better.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. A UC Santa Cruz team of students wins a small farm prize at the inaugural Farm Robotics Challenge. 19 student teams from across the nation competed in the first ever Farm Robotics Challenge, hosted by AI Institute for Next Gen Food Systems, UC Agricultural Natural Resources Vine, Fresno Merced Future of Food, and Innovation and Farm NG. The teams were given tasks of creating robotic solutions to real-life farm automation scenarios. They were judged on design elegance and the ease of use, interdisciplinary inclusion, and societal and economic impact. Executive Director at the USSC Center for Agroecology, Daryl Wong, says, quote, "This project is really exciting because it's bridging what sometimes can feel like really distinct worlds. It speaks to the strength of UC Santa Cruz and how it approaches ag tech, that we can have these conversations that seemingly come from different worlds, but do a really good job to inform and support each other." After citing labor and weeding as two challenges facing small organic growers in California, the Santa Cruz team built an autonomous weeder used in broccoli fields. Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering, Militanovic, says, quote, "At this point, we're pushing the envelope of what is possible in food production. And it's not naive since we have to deal with uncertainties of operations on real farms. Robotics have decades of development, but we're just now in the position to get these robots outdoors and do some real stuff. That's really exciting." The team won the Small Farm Prize, and they received $5,000 as well as a trip to Salinas in September to present at the FIRA USA event.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture is accepting applications for sustainable pest management grants. CDFA's Office of Pesticide Consultation and Analysis is taking grant applications for its Biologically Integrated Farming Systems grant program. A total of $1 million will be available for the current funding cycle. The BIFS grant program helps support on-farm demonstrations and the evaluation of innovative, biologically based farming systems using sustainable pest management strategies.
public or private colleges and universities, local, state, and federal government entities, including tribal governments, nonprofit organizations, and commodity groups are eligible to apply. Applications for the BIFS program are due by 5 p.m. on July 31st. Detailed information on the program is available on the Office of Environmental Farming and Innovation page at cdfa.ca.gov. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Ag export opportunity examples in India. Undersecretary for Rural Development, Jyotil Torres-Small, discusses some of the recent efforts to expand agricultural exports into India, including events at the recent G20 Ag Ministerial held in that nation.
In July, we're going to be welcoming our first shipment of U.S. cherries into India, and we hope to be building on that success in the future. While I was there, I had the chance to experience a Taste of America event, which we held, which is a marketing event. And during that time where American food products were featured in Indian cuisine, I had two importers actually just come up to me and say, hey, we're interested in more wholesale almonds if you know of where we can get them. So it was exciting to be part of those conversations and expanding those markets. Agricultural exports in FY21 were valued at $177 billion, and then in FY22, $196 billion. That's two record-setting years for agricultural exports. So it shows that this type of engagement is crucial, both in terms of international relations, but also for farmers back home.
Here's USDA's Rob Bain and Torres-Small with more on the G20 Ag Ministerial.
Global food security. Among the focal points of this past weekend's G20 Agricultural Ministerial meeting in India.
It was the first time that the G20 Agricultural Ministerial, where countries across the world spoke with one voice about efforts to address world hunger and food insecurity.
USDA Undersecretary for Rural Development, Jyotil Torres-Small, led the U.S. delegation for the meeting. Talking with reporters Tuesday, the undersecretary noted some of the meeting highlights.
We agreed to this outcome report, which included both comments on the Black Sea Grain Initiative, also included the Deccan High-Level Principles, which included U.S. points of emphasis, including investment, innovation, and climate-smart agriculture, as well as encouragement for appropriate food aid.
In addition, USDA hosted a Taste of America High Tea celebration to promote U.S. farm and food goods as export products into India's marketplace. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.